Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome a new guest co-host today, Dr. Deborah Porterfield from the University of North Carolina. Welcome, Deb.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
We're really happy to have you here. You know, you are a real expert in preventive medicine and research and health services, so many things that our listeners are really interested in. So I'm really excited to have you joining us today. And we also are going to have a great guest today, Dr. Adam Sifu, an internist and professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, who's going to be talking about the benefits of building a long-term relationship with doctors. Is it a renaissance or a relic? I'm looking forward to that conversation.
So am I.
First of all, we've got some interesting research that matters. Let's dive right in. And this very first one has to do with a survey from the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. And I know you've done a lot of research with the CDC, looking at what percent of Americans eat fast food every day? Is that important?
I think it's a very important topic, and it's a very alarming statistic, what we have learned from this study, that one out of every three Americans are eating fast food every single day. This survey asked people to recall, did you eat fast food the day before? So that's probably a very good measure. They probably were able to remember what they'd done the day before.
You know, it's interesting what the definition of fast food might be. If you would say, Adam, did you eat fast food in the last day? Well, say I was up in New York City and I went and had a bagel with an egg and cheese. And I guess that was fast food because I got it really fast. But is it the fast food that they were talking about? Well, maybe.
I agree. I think that's a really important question. We think about the chain restaurants, but then now there are many, many kinds of establishments and the whole fast casual phenomenon. So what really counts is fast food?
Yeah, and I think the concern is because the fast food tends to have more things that are bad for us, like higher salt, more sugar, more fat, and less of the things that are good for us, like fruits and vegetables. I mean, I'll be honest, I did not have fruits and vegetables at the bagel place.
And even when you do order a salad or a fruit cup at one of these chain-type restaurants, it really doesn't look like an apple and it doesn't look like lettuce. So you have to wonder, really, was it worth it?
Also, they talk about the portion size. Certainly, I don't typically have a bagel with egg and cheese for breakfast. When I did, because it was there and it looked really good, and I thought this was a treat. But if a third of people are having fast food on a regular basis, that treat becomes not just the donut that I'm having once a month. It may be the donut that I'm having every 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like it's pretty much part of a routine, which is super scary. I'll tell you one interesting thing that we learned from this study. They looked at exactly who among all Americans is more likely to eat fast food. And interestingly, men were more likely than women. And one thing which was very much a surprise to the authors is that individuals who are in higher income groups were actually more likely to eat fast food than those in middle or lower income groups. And that was a real surprise to the authors.
Well, I think this is an important topic. We may even want to have an expert on the topic at some point in time. We're going to ask our great colleagues in the health sciences librarian to put on our website some resources on how to eat healthier fast food, because there probably are some good tips on that. Next, we're going to go on to talk about a really important research that matters. And this is about how doctors, other providers, nurse practitioners feel about caring for transgender patients. I myself have been seeing an increased number of transgender patients coming into our practices. Does that mean that it wasn't there before, or does it mean that I'm just more in tune with it now? Something that we all need to be in tune with.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this article makes me think about when I was a medical student. I was in San Francisco, and it was just as HIV and AIDS was coming to the forefront. And it feels a little bit like that to me today, that now there are new emerging healthcare issues, and yet maybe they've been here all along.
Yeah, I think that is a great point. And, you know, the question among the researchers here, and this was actually research in the Annals of Family Medicine, and they surveyed 308 internal medicine and family practice doctors in a large Midwest healthcare system, and 140 responded. So over half actually didn't respond, which we may talk about in a minute, but they were really wanting to understand, is it the training in transgender care? Is it the familiarity with transgender care? Or what would maybe predict whether or not they were comfortable with seeing transgender patients? Was it knowledge or was it experience?
Mm-hmm. And what was so interesting is it seems to be that just knowing someone, having exposure to persons who are transgender through your life was more important than any specific training.
Yeah, which is really fascinating, because it suggests, and perhaps this is similar to your experience with HIV care, when you don't know someone, there may be things you haven't thought about, and maybe that becomes a barrier versus, you know, you struggle through that first portion of maybe saying things that weren't perfect, and you understand that you're learning and trying, and then you become more comfortable.
Absolutely. Well, I think about, I have kids who are middle and high school right now, and I think about what excellent physicians they could become for taking care of transgender patients, just because how different it is in terms of what kids can be these days and what they share with each other.
You know, I think that's such an important point. We should really do a whole show with a guest on transgender care. Something like over 1 million Americans are transgender. Increasingly, the intersection between healthcare for all and equality in healthcare, important topic. So we're going to ask our executive producer to help us make sure we have a show on this. Let's talk about our next research that matters, which is opioid use and methamphetamine use in pregnancy. What's going on here, Deb?
Well, these are some scary numbers. These authors looked at hospitalizations from the entire United States. So this gives us the picture of overall what's going on. Let's start first with methamphetamine. What's scary here is that numbers are actually starting to decline until about 2008, 2009, and now they're taking off and they're tracking with those opioid numbers that we're all much more familiar with. But the authors here are pointing out that it's not just the opioid, but we've got a meth problem on our hands.
Yeah, the methamphetamine doubled over this 2008-2015 from 1.2 per 1,000 births to 2.4, so a doubling, 100% increase. And opioid use went from 1.5 per 1,000 births to 6.5. Oh, my gosh. Maybe if you had said, would you be surprised if I heard that? I'd say, well, maybe not surprised, but it'd be scary. And to understand that this epidemic, which, you know, increases risk of all sorts of pregnancy outcomes that are really bad for the mother, bad for the child, it's a real problem. We need to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
And it'd be easy to forget about this population, I think, because a lot of them may not be in the traditional groups that get a lot of attention.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about, again, the issue we were just talking about in the other study in terms of what does it take to be able to effectively care for a person with addiction. Well, it may be that you don't have a lot of experience or exposure from your upbringing, and that's another very important barrier.
Yeah, you know, this also is a topic that we could really do a whole show on with some real experts, because I think understanding how we intervene, we've done some real good work in trying to intervene on tobacco use in pregnancy, for instance. But boy, this is really difficult. Let's talk about our last research that matters, Deb, and it's about the impact on weight loss surgery of asking the patients what's most important to them. Seems like a pretty critical question.
Absolutely. Well, I know we're going to talk later on the show about the importance of the doctor-patient relationship, and I'm sure that's very critical. But patients in this study talked about cost, and that was a surprise to the authors.
Yeah, this was in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal called Surgery, and they did a survey of 800 adults who were considering weight loss surgery, and they found out this cost and then how much they can actually lose was more important than perhaps the type of procedure and even the risk of the procedure. Mm-hmm. So suggesting that they might choose a riskier procedure if it were less costly and they could lose more weight rather than considering the complexity or the outcomes of the surgery itself. Mm-hmm. I think this is critical as we look to healthcare reform, and we know the obesity epidemic, that we have to intervene. And there's so few people who could really benefit that are getting the weight loss surgery.
Mm-hmm. And another example of how important it is to talk to the patient and to understand what their priorities are.
We should do that, shouldn't we?
We should.
Well, that'll conclude the research that matters. But when we return, we're actually going to be talking about talking with patients when we talk with Dr. Adam Sifu, internist and professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, about the benefits of building a long-term relationship with doctors, renaissance or relic. All this and much more with Your Health Radio. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Deborah Porterfield. Today on Conversations, Deb, we're talking with Dr. Adam Sifu, internist and professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, about the building of a long-term relationship with patients. Is it a renaissance or a relic? Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Sifu.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
You know, before we begin, because I think this essay will really speak to so many people so broadly, and it certainly speaks to us as providers and our listeners, I guess we'd like to learn a little bit more about you and how you became interested in medicine and general internal medicine. How did that come about?
Sure. It's a great question. I feel like one of those questions that they ask you when you're interviewing for jobs, right? I kind of fell in love with medicine. I'm a general internist, I think, because it's what I pictured a doctor being. You know, it's someone who a patient can come and see for anything and who can treat just about anything that people present with. Or, you know, if that doctor can't treat that, can at least direct the patient in the right direction. I did, during my training, really come to appreciate also the kind of long-standing relationships with patients. And even though in a residency, you know, the longest of those relationships may be 2, 3, 4 years, that sort of, I don't know, got me hooked. And I saw that that's the sort of relationship I wanted to carry on in a professional experience.
Wow. Yeah, I think that speaks to a love of taking care of people and being in relationships in the physician-patient space. Great.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, could you share a little bit about where you've worked and the kinds of practices you've been involved in?
Sure. So I did my internal medicine training in Boston at a program that I was very fortunate was sort of dedicated to primary care and had a, you know, a primary care track where besides all the work in the hospital and the ICU, really focused on building a patient panel who you could take care of. And, you know, that sort of hooked me in. I moved out to Chicago, to the University of Chicago here. Like many of us, I think, I intended to be here for 3 years, and now it's been over 20 years as things have worked out. And it's interesting. You know, you move from place to place. The populations you take care of change. You know, the look of the patients, who they are, what the patient's day-to-day experiences or past history is. But all that kind of becomes unimportant. You know, once you're in a room with people who are coming to the doctor to get help or form a relationship, it's really amazing how similar everybody is. And it's interesting. I remember interviewing, you know, for this job, God, in, I don't know, 96, I guess. And I remember, you know, saying like, these are the patients I want to take care of and whatever I was looking for at the time. And one physician, a woman who I was practicing with, sort of, you know, shook her head and said, like, you know, I don't understand when people say they want to take care of the underserved or they want to take care of an urban population or whatever, because everybody's the same and everybody needs care. And it was sort of shocking to hear that at the time, but I have to say, as my career has progressed, I kind of feel what she was saying.
It's interesting. We are really kind of looking at this long-term relationship and the perseverance, which is why it's a, you know, is that the renaissance of what we have had and need, or is it a relic? And I wonder what prompted you to write this essay in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty internal medicine. Clearly, this was an important part of you and what you feel is important in medicine.
I love your renaissance versus relic, because I feel like a little bit of a relic, right? There are a core group of people who I work with who have been doing this, you know, for as long or longer than I have. But I also see many of our residents going off into professions where they will not have the same sort of experience as I have. And I also see a lot of fellow physicians, faculty members who kind of come and go, you know, work in a practice for 3, 4, 5 years, move on to something else, move on to something else after that. And I, of course, respect those decisions because everybody has to figure out, you know, what they're comfortable with, what works well with their life, and everybody should make their own decision. But sort of deep inside, I feel like, you know, they're missing something by moving on, and their patients certainly are losing something by moving on. I have, on the other hand, I guess, you know, when you speak of renaissance, I do think of some of the newer models, whether it's direct primary care or some of the, whatever we call them, the
concierge medicine.
Yes, concierge medicine, thank you. Which, you know, maybe those a decade from now will look back and say, you know, these have really stood the test of time and have allowed people to reestablish those relationships which are harder to find in what have been traditional practices.
Let's jump into what do you see as the benefits, both to the patients and to the providers, from these long-term relationships?
I mean, I think the benefits to the patients maybe are obvious, right? I mean, I think people figuring out who they feel comfortable with and therefore can call upon that person, whether it's by, you know, phone, email, text, you know, my chart message, or shockingly coming in to see the doctor, is wonderful. It makes the person feel comfortable. It makes the person feel like they can have questions answered in a reliable way. And hopefully it actually improves outcomes for that patient, because that patient will get, whether it's infections or worrisome complaints taken care of in a time-sensitive way, you know, will benefit them over the long term. For physicians, I can mostly speak to myself, is that what it's done for my sort of job satisfaction. We talk a lot about burnout these days, and I think it's part of what prevents burnout in my own professional life, is that I feel like the group of patients who I take care of, and, you know, like many of us, there are hundreds of them, I feel like they're colleagues almost. When I sit down and I look at my schedule for a day, I immediately can call to mind what those patients look like, what they do, who they are, what their families are like. And it really makes those practice sessions go more smoothly for me.
So it's almost like they're colleagues, they're patients, and sometimes even friends, because you share so much common experience.
There's no question. And certainly, I mean, I feel like I'm painting a little bit of a rosy picture, but that's okay. You know, it is wonderful because I really do feel like, you know, the patients and I feel like we're working together towards the same goal. I'm in a setting where, although I work in a city, you know, the neighborhood that we're in is a very close-knit neighborhood where I take care of many of my colleagues, many of my colleagues' families, you know, the parents of many of my children's friends. And so that's wonderful. That does sometimes create problems. You know, the issues of confidentiality, the issues of sitting in an exam room with one patient of whom you take care of, their partner, their children, their parents, can be quite complicated, especially if you're trying to stay on a schedule and get out of that room in 20 minutes. So there certainly is a downside, but I sort of appreciate that, and I think the benefits really outweigh the harms.
You know, we're going to need to take a short break in a second, but I think this intersection of this long-term care, where it makes things easier and where it potentially sometimes makes things more complicated, certainly is part of the conversation and we'll certainly want to pick up on. We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue talking with Dr. Adam Sifu, internist and professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, about the benefits of building long-term relationships with your doctors, renaissance or relic. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Deborah Porterfield. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Deborah Porterfield. We've been talking with Dr. Adam Sifu, internist and professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, about the benefits of long-term relationships with doctors, renaissance or relic. And right before the break, Dr. Sifu, you spoke about kind of this ability to have these relationships with people for whom one sees over time and one can really be there at different life critical events in their health care. And sometimes it's complex. I wonder if you can talk about how is it that you think that really helps patients, maybe vis-a-vis our residents who sometimes are, you know, haven't seen a patient there before, or and every patient is new, versus you who have known these patients for long periods of time.
Right. Adam, that's a great question. I always actually kind of counsel our residents in my effort to have them all become general internists in a stable practice, to tell them that, you know, what they're experiencing is often the hardest part of their professional lives. And it's not that they know less than me, because in many ways they know a whole lot more than I do. But everybody they see is new. Many of those patients, you know, doubt their skills and the quality of care that they're going to provide, and they're all presenting. You know, every patient is presenting often, you know, a menu of concerns to the residents. Many of our residents in I think all primary care fields, be it, you know, family medicine, pediatrics, internal medicine, do so much of their training in the hospital, where they feel like they need to address everything, you know, on day one or you know, in hour one in the visit. And I so often, you know, like a little bit of the slower pace in the office, where a patient can come in with, you know, a list, and I love it when patients bring in lists, but a list of, you know, 10 concerns that they have. And I can say, listen, let's talk about number 1 through 3 today. You tell me what those are. And then slowly over the course of, I don't know, you know, 3 months, 6 months, we can slowly cover that whole list. And the list often changes over those 3 months, ending on the kind of healthcare maintenance, you know, wellness kind of conversations. That's my agenda for the visit, which may happen on visit 6.
I wonder if you could, if you come up with an example in your own practice of how this sometimes, and you mentioned in your article that sometimes it could really be a problem that you maybe you fail to see something that perhaps someone who might be new might have picked up on, you know, anything that may have happened. Because it certainly has happened with me that, you know, I just didn't quite appreciate a subtle change because it was subtle.
Right. And so it's hard. This is one of those things that goes in both directions, and I'm not sure if being at it with the same patients for a long time is good or bad in this respect. You know, on the good side, boy, I think we all have those experiences, right, where a patient comes in and one person, you know, if this person complains to me about anything, that is something I need to address, because that is the most stoic character I take care of. I have one gentleman who I've seen, you know, for 20 years, and I look back on the notes, and he's come in 3 times for specific problems. And in those 3 times, one, he was undergoing bypass surgery the next day. One, I diagnosed him with an enormous abdominal mass. And the third time he had a very severe anemia, because if that guy doesn't have a real problem, he is not going to complain. On the other hand, I'm at a place in my career where a few of my really senior colleagues have retired in the last few years. And as I've picked up their patients, and these were wonderful, wonderful, dedicated doctors, you know, I've picked up some things that they had sort of stopped noticing because they had gotten into such a comfortable routine with the patient that the patient wasn't complaining about things, they weren't examining the patients as closely. And I joke in the article about physician transfer-induced aortic stenosis, where, you know, this patient's seeing their doctor regularly but hasn't had their heart listened to in 5 years. And when I'm saying, you know, I'm going to do a full exam because I haven't met you before, and all of a sudden I'm shocked by a couple of the findings. And that may be a downside to the familiarity that we get with some of our long-term patients.
Well, if we can switch gears and talk a little bit about what are the barriers to the long-term relationships, and is this really a relic? Are we headed in the wrong direction? I think at the beginning you offered a comment about maybe some of these new models of care can foster a renaissance. But first of all, do we know the direction we're headed here? Is this a relic? And what are those barriers that lead to more fragmented relationships?
Knowing that I was going to be talking to you guys today, I was seeing patients this morning and had a conversation about this morning. And I think that there is so much stacked against this sort of experience as we go on in the future. Some of it has to do with the things that we might obviously think about within medicine, that people often, you know, their insurances change and their insurance demands they see new doctors. You know, the doctor moves on because practicing primary care in any field is difficult these days. But a lot of it is also societal, right? You know, many of the physicians who I work with, both them and their partner, are professionals, and it's often that one person needs to move for a different job, and therefore that pulls them away. Our society in general is much more mobile, so often patients are moving to other places. When I meet patients who are young, boy, everybody's life is in flux. So I think there's a lot working against this when you compare it to, say, 50 years ago when most people got out of school, got a job, and were in that job for 40 years, seeing that same physician who was working in their own private practice, which they had invested a lot of time and energy into.
Yeah, I wonder, in the context of today's provider-patient relationship, are there some things that you think foster, though, the direction that you want to go in? And I'm just thinking about something so simple. I know sometimes the more difficult, the longer time I have invested in something that's happening with the patient will say something at the end like, you know, thank you, Dr. Goldstein. I really appreciate, you know, you making a phone call. And it's like, really? All I had to do was make a phone call and you're appreciative? But this gratitude is almost like a talisman. It's a lucky charm that just wants, like, oh, you just gave me another week in practice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. That's a great way to put it. You know, I wrote recently in another article about my sunshine folder, and my sunshine folder, I despise the name, but somebody gave that to me, you know, 20, 25 years ago, and it's a place that I just throw all those little thank you notes and, you know, all those cards and stuff in. And on a bad day, you know, looking through that and see how much people appreciate the work we do, usually in an unspoken way, is enormously rewarding. One thing that we have tried to do in our practice is recognizing that early on it's hard. And usually when people join a practice, not only is their clinical life difficult, but they're also in a period both professionally and personally where things are maybe a little bit more unstable, right? They've just moved to a new place. They've just taken on a new job. You know, they're at a place where maybe they have young children. And that's the time that people need the most support. You know, those first 3 to 5 years, if they're going to really succeed. And then after 5 years, if they've sort of made it through that time, you know, then they're getting the feedback from their patients. Their work with their patients becomes a little bit easier. They're getting more of those thank yous. And they have kind of less chance of burning out if they can get through that early, really difficult time.
Well, unfortunately, we're headed to the end of our time. But as we wrap up, any final thoughts you'd like to leave with the listeners?
Well, I guess I hope I've inspired a couple of doctors. And also, I think it's interesting. You know, we're all patients as well. And I really do work when I'm on the other side of the table, you know, when I'm the patient talking to the doctor of expressing how much I appreciate that person's attention, because I also, from a patient perspective, recognize that it's difficult when that person you've come to rely on, you know, moves on, and you need to spend the effort to set up a whole new relationship with somebody else.
You know, I think, though, this idea of being appreciative, I don't know how often I do it, but maybe I can vow to do it more, which is to tell patients how much I appreciate them trusting me and coming to me and fostering this appreciation. Because, as you said, we hope it's a renaissance and not a relic.
Yes, that's very well put.
Well, we want to thank you, Dr. Adam Sifu, for being our guest today on Your Health. We're going to put up a link to this article for Your Health listeners. I think our listeners will enjoy reading it and thinking and having their own conversations with their loved ones and their providers.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the time.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Deborah Porterfield. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segments for our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
My doctor recently gave me a medicine called clotrimazole for ulcers in my mouth. It worked really well, but when I stopped it, the ulcers came back several months later. I'm on prednisone for a chronic joint problem. Am I going to need to take this medication for life?
This is a difficult question, and it seems easy and straightforward, which is you're on a medication, it worked, you stopped it, it didn't work, but then you throw in the fact that you're on prednisone. And I know, Deb, you cared for patients in the past who were on prednisone for all kinds of things. It's a medicine that changes the equation, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Certainly does. I guess one question is if you think you're going to be on prednisone for the rest of your life, but certainly the prednisone is setting you up for these chronic ulcers in your mouth.
Yeah. Most likely it's that medicine clotrimazole is an antifungal agent. So you probably had what we call yeast or type of fungus in the mouth, yeast-like. And good news is that it went away pretty easily, and that's a pretty easy medicine to treat it with, and it kind of treats it kind of topically there. So, and you know, what I would really say is you're probably going to need to work with your provider. You're going to need to work with your primary care provider. You're going to need to work with your maybe subspecialty provider, maybe with this rheumatologist, if they're working with you on the prednisone, to see, can you get on a medicine other than prednisone to control this? And then, you know, are there other things you could do? Maybe you don't have to use this clotrimazole every day once it's under control, but maybe you have to use it once a week or twice a week, some way of kind of preventing that from coming back.
That sounds like good advice to me.
Yeah. It sounds like it could have been uncomfortable, and we're really sorry to hear that. I hope you're doing better. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've been communicating with my physician through the electronic medical portal and also through texting, as she once called me to go over lab results. Recently, she seemed a little irritated at the number of conversations we were having, although I do have a serious medical condition, and it's very scary. What advice can you give me?
Well, there's lots of things to say about this one. First off, I'm pleased at some levels that you have access to this provider that most patients probably don't have access to. Certainly the electronic medical portal, that's a good thing, and that you're using it and the provider's using it. Sounds like you also have some access because you have the telephone number, though I don't know if the physician said it's okay to call me on that telephone number or text me on that telephone number.
Mm-hmm. That would be important, I think, at your next face-to-face encounter, your next visit, to talk with them about the best ways for you to communicate with them and about the right ways to go about doing it.
Yeah, you know, I give out my telephone number at times to patients, usually very purposefully. I do sometimes call patients back when I'm trying to, you know, be on the road or get a message. And I don't always think about, oh, you know, they may use this and have my number and contact me. But I think it's okay for the physician to say, you know, that's not okay. I didn't, you know, I don't really like getting text messages back. I'd like you to use this system because it sounds like the system actually works. You do get messages to the provider through that portal, and that's what that system is designed for. It's not designed for texting necessarily for usual care.
And there's some really important things to talk about in terms of that system. Let's think about if you're texting your provider and you're on your phone, it says your medical conditions, what medicines you're taking, and then you lose your phone. So it's very important that you keep your own medical information private, and that's what these systems are designed to do. And so although they may seem a little clunky and there may be a more of a delay in reaching your provider, but that's the safe place to put that kind of information and those questions that you have for your provider.
Like what if you were sending a picture of your rash and it's on an area of the body that maybe is a little bit more private? This could be all kinds of problems.
You here. Certainly don't want that over the airwaves.
Right. And yet you can send those pictures through the portal, which is a secure environment to receive those types of pictures.
Yeah, so important to keep that kind of information in a safe place.
Laura, as a patient, what would you think about if a provider says, you know, I wasn't really irritated, but you're using the system in a way that perhaps is not how it's intended. I'm a little bit uncomfortable. Here are the reasons why, and I prefer you to use the patient portal. Would that feel okay, or would that feel like I'm not being caring enough, doesn't really understand how severe my condition is?
Oh, no, I wouldn't think that. I think I might feel a little embarrassed for having sort of misread the system, but as long as the provider approaches it in a way that shows that, you know, we need to change this, but I still really care, then I imagine that I'd get over it pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And there can also be the question, which is, now for most of my questions, we'll use the portal, but would it be appropriate if I text you if this is something going on? And so it could still be something that's an emergency or a backup system, but most of the communication is happening through that portal.
Yeah, I get sometimes a text message that your patient or my mom is in the emergency room.
Yeah.
Okay. That's okay.
That's the right time to use that text.
Yep. Need some help here. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I had a wellness physical through my work, which really involved taking some lab tests. They told me to talk with my doctor about the results. My doctor, however, said that they didn't do the test at their office, so they wanted me to come talk about those results rather than comment on someone else's lab tests. Is that reasonable?
This is right in line with some of the things we've just been talking about, Deb. This complexity of these new healthcare systems and interventions. And here's a good example. I have patients who do get their blood work from labs outside of the system, which I operate because they get it for free. And yet they also want me to be the ones to marshal and to comment and to discuss those labs when I didn't order them.
That's a really challenging position to put your doctor in. There might be something that was going on with you that day that leads to a slightly abnormal lab result. And then how would they know that if they're looking just at this blood test? So I would encourage you to go in. If you want to discuss your results, go into your provider and talk about why you got the tests and if there was anything going on that day that led you to get these tests. It sounds like this was just a worksite wellness visit. But in any event, it would be so hard for them to interpret some labs without having the opportunity to discuss it with you.
And now they're also responsible in part for that conversation and the outcomes of that conversation. So I think open and transparent.
Mm-hmm. And again, help your doctor, your primary care doctor, be that point person that you will always go back to. So if you see another provider, you have these lab tests, but then bringing it back to your primary care doctor so that they can coordinate all of your care.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls, and we want to thank all of our listeners for joining us today for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can share any question or story by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu, follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes, or our health app. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Adam Sifu, and I want to thank our great guest co-host, Dr. Deborah Porterfield. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.